Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
My first ever gig was when my daughter was 14, my little one was 14. And the reason I could start comedy then was because I didn't need a babysitter anymore. You know, until then I worked full time. How could I possibly work full time, pay a babysitter and go out in the evenings? I'd never have seen my kids. But by the time they were 14 and 17, they couldn't give a shit. They were delighted that I was going out at night. So that definitely was had an impact on why I started comedy so late.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to stand-up comedian, writer, executive coach and public speaker, Callie Beaton. Perfect. Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond. Balancing Acts is now made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who are a website and community that support independent comedy creators such as myself. I have a Comedy Crowd short, which is a 2-minute video, one of my characters on their website. They showcase the best new videos on Comedy Crowd TV, which is comedycrowdtv.com, and across media platforms, so do go and check them out. Callie has worked as a TV executive at companies including MTV, UK TV and Viacom, and partly responsible for bringing shows such as South Park onto the air. She was a senior vice president at Viacom, and whilst working at Comedy Central in 2015, she began performing stand-up and was encouraged by Joan Rivers, no less, to pursue it as a career. She has also headed up an independent television production company that was bought by ITV's at the time, Colton Television. She has written for the likes of Guardian. In 2014, she founded Road Trip Media. She's a BAFTA voting member and holds a seat on the development board of MTV's Staying Alive Foundation. And if that wasn't enough, she's also appeared on BBC Two's QI numerous times. She's been a guest on the likes of Radio 4's Museum of Curiosity and BBC Radio 6 Music and BBC London. And she's also been a panelist on Radio 4's The Unbelievable Truth with David Mitchell and BBC's The Blame Game. Callie's taken two solo shows to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which received 4-star reviews from the likes of The Scotsman and Funny Women. She won the 2018 Piccadilly Comedy Club New Act of the Year competition and has been tipped from Chortle as one of the comedians to watch. I'm exhausted just reading that out. She's packed in a lot, as we did in this episode. So we cover a load of ground, including why running and exercise is so important to Callie's mental health, why she left her job as vice president of Viacom to pursue a career of public speaking and stand-up comedy. And she explains this concept of when in reinventing yourself, you can upsize as opposed to downsize. And she explains that as a coach, she would often talk to clients who wanted to make career changes to hone in on deciding how to make choices on how you make your money. And that will hopefully lead you to pursuing a career that you enjoy and are passionate about. And she discusses the idea of everyone needing to do their stint as a barista or equivalent before pursuing a career as a comedian or a performer, just to develop that work ethic. She explains what NLP is and how her curiosity of people and the world around her led her to study it and the impact it's had on her. We talk about how she's adapted during these lockdown times, why she writes projects at the last minute. We talk about our respective addictions to our phones. And Callie describes the experience of attending the Hoffman Process retreat, where she was cut off from technology for a week or maybe perhaps 10 days. And we also share our fellow retreat experiences. Callie breaks down why it's so important to turn up every day, even when you're not feeling creatively inspired. And she tells a story, a fascinating story, on when Jerry Seinfeld was early on in his stand-up career and he was thinking about giving up, how a group of working builders inspired him to stick with it and go up a level in terms of his dedication and professionalism. Callie describes what it's like being a single mother of two whilst working a full-time job and then, you know, also becoming a stand-up comedian. She explains the idea of the Eisenhower matrix and how she applies it to her time management and why time spent on the wrong thing blocks you from allowing really the right things or opportunities to turn up in your life. We also discuss Callie's debut Edinburgh Fringe experience and the transition from attending Edinburgh Fringe as a TV exec where everybody wanted her at their parties to then being a comedian that wasn't really getting the same level of attention and what that was like, and also the struggles of dealing with Edinburgh Fringe emotionally and mentally. She breaks down the experience of being on a panel show such as QI. There is loads here. If you're someone who's maybe contemplating a career change, perhaps slightly later in life, or you know, maybe you've been working somewhere for a few years and you're like, nah, this ain't for me. Well, then this episode will be inspirational for you because, you know, Callie was in a very successful corporate career or as a media executive. And then she decided to go all in on the comedy and public speaking, and it's worked out pretty well for her so far. So I think you're going to be inspired by Callie and hearing her journey. So over to Callie. Perfect. Okay, so first things first, and I'm sure you however many different interviews or podcasts you've had since, I'm sure a lot of people have asked you the same question. How are you post corona, having corona, as someone who's actually had it?
Who thinks of it? I mean, I've still not been tested and I've not had the antibody test, but I'm pretty confident after 7 weeks of quite severe respiratory coughing type illness that it was COVID. Yeah. So, and I'm actually hoping to get antibody tested next week for what that's worth. So, I mean, I think just having, I got my sort of serious symptoms on the second day of lockdown. So it was really weird because just when everyone was getting used to the challenges of lockdown, I was flat out with this blooming thing. And then I thought I was all right after a couple of weeks, which is what seems to be the pattern with people with this. And then it hit me really hard and I got pneumonia. And then that laid me out for another month. So in total, I had sort of 6 weeks when I was, well, there were lots of days I just couldn't do anything. I could barely get as far as the kind of bathroom. So it was really grim. And so even though everybody was feeling very locked down, quite understandably, I would be hearing people outside my house kind of going out for a walk with their dogs or chatting to someone kind of like across the road. And I was like, God, I'm literally just stuck in the house. So it was quite grim. And then physically, I'm fairly fit. You know, I run and I'm pretty healthy, but I felt it did literally take me 7 weeks to start. I went for my first run 7 weeks after my last run. And that's someone who's never missed a run in 20 years. So, yeah. So yeah, there you go.
I can feel your pain in terms of also being someone that's very active. I'm not a good patient. I'm not good at just sitting there doing nothing. It's not easy. So how was the first run back?
It was all right. Yeah, it was all right. I was sort of, anyway, do you run?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, because anyway, you know what it's like if you run and you sort of, it's kind of addictive anyway, and you sort of do it more days than you don't. Mm. So even if you miss a run under normal circumstances, you're like, oh, I've probably lost my running form. So after 7 weeks, I was like, I've never had that long off running. And I'm not getting any younger. Maybe this is it and I won't be able to run. No, it was fine. It still feels, my breath still feels like I'm breathing on a cold day when I run. Like it feels really sharp still. But I can, my breath sort of, I've got capacity in my lungs. It just hurts. But I don't think I'm doing myself any harm. And I'm determinedly going to keep running. I mean, it keeps me sane, really, which I know we'll talk about. But I'm not, I'd rather risk permanent damage to my lungs, but keep mentally well. I think that's the right trade-off.
That's balance.
Yeah, so but it's been all right. I've been running every couple of days ever since then, and I'm back on form now.
That's the best thing, isn't it? Once you've been ill, and then firstly to have your health back again, you sort of like, because it's so easy to take it for granted because you're just getting on with your normal life. But once you've been ill, just to feel healthy again, and then also to be able to do physical exercise and lead a sort of normal life is a nice feeling.
Yeah, it does feel good. And even, you know, sometimes you sort of feel like you don't want to do exercise. You're like, oh, I can't be bothered to run, or I can't be bothered to go for a swim. And as I was lying there, I thought, I am never complaining about going for a run ever again. If I'm well enough to run, I will be thankful that I'm well enough to run. So it's been a good leveler for me about exercise and just really enjoying exercise again. So yeah, I'm definitely sort of pretty much back to normal now, as much as any of us are back to normal.
Yeah. So are you... Because you've done so much. Like, there's so many different things I want to talk to you about. Do you still work as a senior vice president at Viacom?
So I left that job very stupidly. Left that job a couple of years ago, just when I could really do with the job security now. So I left that job in 2018, and I still do bits of work in telly.
Okay.
And in fact, that's one of the things I'm doing during lockdown. So I'm lucky that I've still got things going on, not production, but sort of more on the business side and the sort of development side. So I'm working with a couple of the big companies on a few things during lockdown. So at least that's giving me a little bit of work and a bit of, just something to do with my brain, really.
Yeah.
So, that my last sort of major day job ended on my instigation a couple of years ago.
Okay. And was that to focus on stand-up comedy more sort of full-time?
It was partly to focus on stand-up, and because that was starting to get more of a clash, because Viacom, as you probably know, they own, among other things, they own MTV, Nickelodeon, but they also own Comedy Central and Channel 5. So it was starting to get a little bit... No, they were brilliant and really supportive, but once I started getting sort of telly and radio work on screen, it was starting to become really weird that I was also somebody off screen and involved in companies who were commissioning people that I was working with. Not that they were commissioning me, you know, I wasn't getting any favors or anything. I've never done any shows on screen for Viacom. So it wasn't like I was commissioning myself, but it just felt increasingly like there was going to be a bit of an oddness around that. And everyone was good enough to sort of be really supportive, but I kind of thought, it doesn't quite feel right anymore. And then also I sort of make my living out of public speaking, really. So even though my time is spent 50-50 stand up and sort of after dinner speaking and giving speeches at conferences and stuff.
Right.
The conferences are obviously what pay a lot of money, the corporates, or a lot of money compared to stand up, a lot of money, although anything's a lot of money compared to stand up. And it was starting to get to the point where I was getting asked to do speeches. And because I was also a Viacom, senior manager, it wouldn't have been all right for me to just go and do like a speech whoever it was, for the NHS or for an insurance company or whatever, because I was their person. So I couldn't just go off and do my own public speaking career, which I started to really want to do. And I started to get a lot of opportunities, and I was turning stuff down because it was a clash with my day job. And I thought, maybe I can make a living out of public speaking and stand up. So kind of basically give me a microphone, put me on a stage, and I'll try and address the situation, whether it's comedy or something more corporate. So that's why I left, really, to try and go it alone as a performer and speaker, not just a comic, but comedy front and center.
So it sounds like it was quite like a seamless transition, moving from, I guess we can say, the equivalent of being behind the camera to in front of the camera, to being someone that was working with talent to then being talent yourself. Was that like a shift in sort of like a mindset? But I guess you're kind of used to it if you've been sort of doing live public speaking for a number of years. You already had that within you.
I suppose I had. It's funny because one of the things I talk about when I do speeches, one of the big things I talk about, and I'm working on a book about it at the moment, is reinvention and how you can... how you can reinvent and go bigger, not smaller. So people sometimes assume that if you reinvent, you're downsizing. And there's a lot being written about that, give up all your worldly possessions and, go and run a lavender farm in Provence. And that's great. Good luck to anyone who does that.
Yeah.
But I've sort of gone, I've upsized, not downsized. So I've got more high profile at an age when you're meant to get more invisible. So one of the things that I talk about when I talk about reinvention is the idea of what's portable, what can you take with you? So when you decide to do something different, what are the things you did in your last job or the things you've learned on the planet that you can take with you and help you do the new thing? So I suppose I didn't really think of it like this at the time, But I suppose everything I'd done before this kind of led to this in a way. So doing lots of public speaking and being a sort of person who made my living out of words, essentially, albeit words on behalf of a company. But it was all about me communicating messages, I guess. And then it was just a different version of doing it. So I suppose I was used to the being able to hold sort of big rooms, and I find it easier to hold a big room for a corporate than I do for a gig, which is, I know most comedians say the other way around, because it's what I'm used to doing. But I suppose the big shift of mindset was you sort of live or die on your own sword now. You know, I've got no one to protect me if it goes wrong, if I can't work, if I muck it up, you know, it's on me. Obviously, I don't have that luxury of the lovely support structure. So I had, you know, a lot of people around me at Viacom, brilliant people, most of whom I still kind of am in touch with. And I'll also, obviously, financially, and I'm a single parent, it's kind of on me to make a living. So I kind of, there's no buffer zone. But I'm free, you know, nobody can control what I do or don't do. And I'm ready for that at this stage in my life. Someone described it to me. Another woman my kind of age, she said, your wise mind just gets wiser. And I do remember sitting in a boardroom quite near the end of my time at Viacom and just looking around and thinking, I think I might be about to say what I actually think. it might be time to go. And I just couldn't, I knew how to play the game. And, they're great people. It's a great company. But I'd done my time and it was time to move on. So, yeah, so I suppose it was a big leap and it wasn't a big leap in answer to your question.
Yeah. But I guess from an outsider's perspective, you could look at it and go, wow, that takes a lot of courage to do that, particularly because you have, in a way, you've got more to lose to a certain respect if you've had such a successful corporate career, and to sort of turn your back on that. But it's great that you knew that you were ready. So that's my Bluetooth speaker and it always goes off. I always forget to switch off. It always goes off.
I don't know. It's not a podcast without someone's electronics doing something rogue. So yeah. It's authentic. I think it's in terms of the sort of courage that it takes, I always used to, you know, I've worked as you know, as an executive coach for a long, long time, and another thing I'm doing during lockdown is quite a bit of coaching. And I always used to say to people who I would coach, because a lot of people, when they come for coaching for whatever reason, actually want a big change of direction in their lives, or they're debating one. And one of the things I would always work with them on was, you know, if the only thing keeping you where you are is money, albeit, you know, you've got to earn a crust, but if that's the only reason making you do something, absolutely you might need to do it for a bit longer, and we all need to earn a crust, but then it's time to start thinking what you would rather be doing, because it's incredibly hard to sustain a working life that's just for the money. And that sounds like a very privileged position, and I'm not, you know, I don't come from privilege. I've got no one backing me up financially, never have done. So it's not about being born into money or anything. It's about deciding to make choices as to how you make your money, if you possibly can. So at the point at which I knew I wasn't just there for the money. I loved my career in the media, and I worked really hard to build up to the point I was. But I did get to the point where I thought, if someone said to me, you don't ever have to worry about money again, I probably wouldn't do this job anymore. And then I thought, well, then it's time to go. You need to find another way to earn some cash. So I was really practicing what I preach in coaching and trying to sort of live by my values. So yeah, that's I decided, not that it's a dirty dollar, but I decided not to take the dirty dollar anymore. Now obviously I take dirty beer tokens and no dollars, but you know, it was a nice idea at the time.
Yeah, the romanticism of going into the world of comedy, and then the reality is somewhat different.
It surely is. I mean, I knew that because I guess I've worked in comedy most of my TV career. So as well as working, I've worked for Comedy Central on and off for about 20 years.
Yeah.
I've worked with quite a lot of the major comedy producers in the UK. So I've been on the other side of comedy most of my career.
Were you working as a commissioner?
No, I was never a commissioner. So I worked on the business side. So I was there to, I worked primarily on the international side of television. So I would sit on the development boards for different creative companies, sometimes comedy companies.
Okay.
And I would be the person working out how we could sort of monetize the ideas around the world. So is this going to be something that's going to work? You know, so I worked on South Park back when it was first created. And was that something we thought we could make money on around the world? Obviously the answer, as it turned out, was yes. I'm ashamed to say at the time I was first asked, I was like, no, this is 21 years ago. No one was doing that kind of thing. I was like, nah, this is a bit niche.
It will never work.
It never worked. So I wasn't a commissioner, but I was involved in commissioning decisions based on the fact that I was looking at what the international potential was. So I was always looking at, can we make money out of this? If we do it in the States or we do it in the UK,
yeah,
how can we make some money out of it around the world? So I was involved in that process, but I was never a commissioning editor.
And do you think having worked on that side of things, has that massively helped you in terms of the other side of your comedy career, in terms of figuring out your branding and all that sort of thing, and also just like your work ethic?
Yes. I mean, the answer to, and it sounds really like arrogant, yes, I'm brilliant at both of those things. That's not what I mean. But yeah, I think there's, I mean, to answer your second bit of that question first, so work ethic, I always kind of jokingly say, you know, everyone needs to do their stint as a barista or as a, you know, behind a bar or whatever. And some comics, you know, I got into comedy at 45. I did my first ever gig at 45. And obviously there are some comics who are starting out in their teens and some who are good enough and deserve to make it big, you know, in their 20s. And they've never, so I've got hay fever. This isn't, I know no one listening can see this, but I'm rubbing my nose in a very cocaine-fueled manner. But it's not a relic from my MTV days. It's just hay fever. But so people who get straight into comedy without having had a real job, I think sometimes don't have the housekeeping skills to know how to keep things. You know, maybe they're just young. You know, I think when I was young, I wouldn't have known what to do. So I will kind of organize myself and have a work ethic. I think lots of young comedians, this is going to come across really badly, lots of young comedians and comedians of all ages have a work ethic.
Yeah.
But I think I think in terms of like keeping my little black book of contacts alive and just trying to make sure I kind of, you know, always am very, very follow up on things and do things in the way that I would like to be done to. I suppose that's something I've learned with time on the planet. Appreciate the irony of me telling this to you, who I've rescheduled the podcast with about 17 times. You're probably like, Kelly, you weren't very professional with me, but I apologize for that. I think that I did sort of learn that experience from working. What was the other bit of your question? You said,
yeah, I guess in terms of it having an impact on the branding side of things.
Oh, yeah.
and you know, the way that you market yourself as a comedian, because it is important.
It's really important. And again, I definitely don't think of myself as someone who has a real, I don't ever stop and go, oh, what's my brand? How am I coming across? I don't ever sort of sit and have a sort of marketing conversation with myself, but I am aware that probably because I've been involved in marketing TV shows and creative ideas my entire career since I was, you know, 21, I suppose it's instinctive to me to sort of get out there and I'll do the best with what I've got, definitely. So if anything is going on that's positive or I want people to know about, I will absolutely get it out there. But it's just sort of instinctive. It's not a sort of cynical, I'll take over the world thing.
Yeah.
So I realize it at gigs. Sometimes people say, oh my God, your career's going so well, Kelly. And I'm like, it really isn't. My marketing of my career might be going well, but there's nothing better about what I'm doing than most other people you'll meet. So I think some people undermarket themselves, and no one can accuse me of undermarketing myself.
Yeah, I think in this industry, perception is massive in terms of, like, as you said, people just say, oh, you're doing this, this and this. And their perception is different from what you consider the reality to be.
Definitely. But
as long as they think you're doing great, that's all that matters.
Yeah, there's definitely people I'm sure you've seen it as well. It's the classic comedians thing. I'd like to say I've never done this. Possibly I have. People where you see them absolutely die on their ass at a gig and you're there and you're like, blimey, that was a rough one. And fair play, we all have them. And then you see them on Twitter later, you know, maybe it was a big club, but they still died up there. And they're like, you know, oh, I've just had the best night of my life, you know, at the Comedy Store or the Boat Show. And you're like, oh, you didn't though, did you? But then, of course, a very small handful of people know what happened. And the rest of everybody else thinks, amazing, you're at that big club and you're smashing it. So I think there are plenty of, and maybe some people think they do smash it when they don't, I don't know. But I do think there's a bit of I was on stage at this big venue, I'd like everyone to know, and no one needs to know, it didn't go quite right. So I suppose we're all making a fist of what we've got, aren't we?
Yeah, we're making the best of it. So you're also a master practitioner in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which is like, isn't that the basis of what Tony Robbins bases his approach to coaching on? Is that right?
First of all, I'd like to just disassociate myself from Tony Robbins and say that. So I think it's probably part of the melting pot of the whole phenomenon that is Tony Robbins. I don't know if anyone's seen that. Did you see the Netflix documentary about him? Yeah, it says it all, really. So I'd like to, first of all, sound very different to Tony Robbins. So NLP, yeah, neuro-linguistic programming, it's quite hard to describe, but it's basically the study of subjective behavior and experience. So it's looking at the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we behave. And it's looking at how we do stuff. So if somebody does something kind of brilliant, how could you model it and learn to do it based on their sort of thinking, speaking, and neurological patterns? So you learn various techniques about how you manage all those aspects of yourself. You get aware of that. And it was originally, it's a sort of melting pot of a huge number of other things that went before it. So it was, I think it was in the 1960s that it was sort of, it was come up with. And by then it sort of took all the best bits of psychological movements that had gone before it. And it was a sort of a way of a sort of amalgamation of things that had gone first. So I did it. I'm not, by the way, but some people listening will know what NLP is and will have a really strong opinion about it. Some people absolutely hate it and think it's almost like witchcraft. Some people won't know what it is and some people won't care. And I don't mind where anyone falls into any one of those camps, because I've never been evangelical about NLP. I think it's a useful tool that I use in coaching and I've used in life a bit, but it's only one of many. I'm not obsessed with it by any means. And for me, it was more about the life experience of studying it. So I did it when I was on the board at Carlton Television, which was part of ITV, and I was quite young to have got that job. And it was only because a small company I was running got bought by a big company. So I found myself in a sort of senior corporate role without knowing that's where I was going. And that's when I started studying NLP. And it was really to sort of reconnect myself with people and the human experience, instead of just being all about the bottom line and all about kind of, I was in a boardroom full of kind of pale, male, stale telly people. And it just didn't feel right. So I did it really as a means of kind of being curious about the world and thinking about people as opposed to money, really. So I did it as a sort of self-development thing, honestly, rather than anything else. And I'm really glad I did it. I did it over 20 years ago and it really helped me. But I did it with someone who's a very experiential teacher called Sue Knight. I did my NLP with her, and I've never done any NLP with anyone else, but from what I gather, it's used as a sort of gimmicky, a bit of a sort of David Brent type thing by lots of people. So you go and learn a little toolkit of NLP, and then you go and try and sort of out body language people at work and, you know, influence them to get what you want. And it all sounds a bit gimmicky and tacky. And the way I did it, I was lucky that I did it with someone where it wasn't really like that. It was much more about understanding yourself and how you communicate. It was much more, it felt like it had a bit more, something that was more personally interesting and authentic. So that's probably the least comedic answer you've ever had to a question on this podcast, but nonetheless,
you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Would I bar that low for comedy? Blimey.
So would you say that you've like incorporated that into your approach to stand up, or is it more of a case of, well, if it kicks in, it's like it's more of a subconscious thing rather than actively using it?
I don't actively use it in anything. So anything,
right, okay.
You know, there's the whole thing with like learning new things, and they say, you know, you're unconsciously incompetent, then you're consciously incompetent, then you get conscious competence. And at the top of the pyramid is unconscious competence. So you're working your way through levels of how you use things that you know, from not even knowing you should be doing it or could be doing it through to doing it effortlessly. And the bits of NLP, because it's been so long ago, the bits that are interesting to me and work for me, I've just assimilated into me now, because it's been such a long time. So I don't ever think, oh, I'm using a bit of NLP. I suppose it's part of all the things I do. But in terms of comedy, no, I mean, God, I'm just like everyone else, just desperately trying to get a laugh and trying to write something that's not absolutely dog shit awful. So I wish I had some kind of witchery or magic that made me able to be better at comedy because of NLP, but I think it makes no blooming difference at all. So it might help me get on with people sometimes off stage, you know, maybe it helps me be a bit smoother with how I, not smoother, but, you know, connect with people. And I don't think it hurts to know how to build rapport with people. So I suppose I know how to do that. But no, on stage, it's just you, the microphone, and a load of blank faces, or at the moment, no faces and no microphone.
Just staring into a webcam. Have you done any gigs via Zoom?
Yeah, it was weird as well, because, I mean, you wouldn't think you'd have FOMO during lockdown, would you? But because of that first month or 6 weeks when everybody, I mean, it's been so tough for everybody in our world. And I'm so privileged compared to lots of people who, I was reading a thing, I think in The Guardian, about Lauren Patterson having had to go back and get a real job. And, you know, I mean, incredibly talented comics like her, because she's not been born into any kind of privilege and hasn't got anyone to help support her, she's just got to go out and earn a living. And that's no bearing on how great her talent is. You know, she's someone who should absolutely be able to make a living just out of what she does on stage. So there's so many people who are like Lauren and who deserve a lot more than they can get in lockdown. And I'm lucky that being a bit older and having worked a corporate job, you know, I do need to earn money, but it's not desperate. You know, I've got a tiny bit of a buffer zone. I'm having to find other ways to earn money, but I've got options.
Yeah.
So I'm aware of I'm checking my privilege on that. But it is true that despite all of that, because I was sort of out of commission for those first few weeks of lockdown and sort of in and out of social media, depending how well or ill I was feeling, and it seemed to me that everyone was doing amazing things. I was like, oh no, everyone's written a book, launched a podcast, doing an amazing Insta Live thing, been all over The Guardian. And I felt like the whole comedy world had adapted brilliantly and I was just stuck in bed doing nothing.
Yeah.
So then I did do a couple of gigs while I was ill, but in little windows, and I thought I was better and then proved not to be better. And then I've done a few since I've been well, but I probably haven't done as many as lots of people because I haven't been in the sort of circuit. But I've been doing corporate stuff via Zoom. I did a whole day of stuff today on Zoom, and I don't mind it. I think it's fine. You know, I see it more as TV presenting than a normal speech. I sort of think of it more as doing a broadcast than a speech or than a gig. And I think it's not easy. And I blooming miss live comedy. And I really miss, I mean, I drove past the Bill Murray the other night and I just started crying. I was like, oh, I used to be here once a week. And I had to email Barry and say, Barry, I've just driven past Bill Murray. And I started crying. Probably lots of people have said that. So yeah, I have tried some live ones. Have you?
I've done, yeah. I've only done one. I haven't been writing new material. That's the thing. Like, I guess I do it just to sort of keep those muscles, or you know, have that, keep that instinct, and just to do it. But I don't know. Like, it's hard. I mean, you can obviously write stuff about lockdown, but I haven't really felt motivated to be honest with you. I've been writing scripts, and I've been enjoying doing that.
What are you writing though? What sort of scripts?
I've just finished a sitcom pilot, which was for Channel 4. So that was good. That's taken quite a few months, and now I've just sent over the final draft to them. That's like the main thing. It was one of those projects. It's so different. I don't know how you feel about deadlines, but I've been talking about this before with other guests, the importance of deadlines, and when, you know, they're self-imposed, it's different to when somebody says, right, we're paying you money and we need you to get this done by this point. And I really enjoyed that. And then since that's been delivered, I've got a few other different projects that I'm developing, but it's not the same urgency there, particularly at the moment with what's going on. Are you, I imagine you are very good at sort of giving yourself deadlines.
No, you imagine entirely wrong. I'm not at all good at that. So
okay.
I normally put myself under real pressure of like huge amount of work. So normally I've got a lot of external pressure because I'm busy. And no, I'm terrible. Like I've done I won't say for whom in case anyone listens to this, but I was delivering a big bit of work for one of the biggest British TV companies this week.
Okay.
And I've had weeks that they booked me to do it 6 weeks ago. And I literally I started delivering it on Tuesday. And Monday night, I was like, I better write this. And then, of course, I'm working every night this week because every day I'm doing more of it for them. So, I mean, I'm an idiot. So I always leave it till the last minute. And I'm terrible. I'm not terrible at, but I find writing creatively incredibly hard. So writing sort of speeches and seminars and articles, you know, I've written a bit for some of the broadsheets and stuff. I can sort of knock out those okay. But I think writing jokes I find really hard. And I only really ever write comedy when I know I've got a gig coming up, like probably most of us. But also I do loads of emceeing and I write a lot on my feet. You know, I muck about with audiences.
Right.
And if I've got a bit of a germ of an idea, I'll sort of muck around with it as an MC. So it's kind of the lazy person's writing, isn't it? Or the untalented person's writing. So just do it when things come up on stage. So the problem with that is my whole career is very dependent on crowd work. My writing, my performance, even how I do corporates, I massively rely on what I do with audiences in the room.
Yeah.
And we haven't got any of that now, have we? So no, in answer to your question, I've barely written a thing in lockdown, or certainly barely written a comedy thing. If I do have a gig coming up, I've got one on Friday, I will write something for it. So I have got a bit of lockdown material. But, you know, you're not exactly honing it, are you? You do it like once or maybe twice. Mm. And then that's not topical anymore and no one cares. So I think it's very hard to write stand-up without anything to write for, because our opinion about something today is going to be completely different by the time we're actually back out gigging again. So, you know, our observations won't be relevant. So I am wondering whether to completely sack off any material I've ever done before and just set myself the challenge when we go back of just starting afresh with brand new material. Because I think by then I'll be so sick of my old stuff. I feel like I'm dusting off my, you know, Nana's old, you know, knickers from the cupboard if I get out with my old material. So I feel I need to maybe start again. But no, I'm not at all good at writing. No. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
Yeah, it's a struggle.
What's your work? Sorry to cut across you. What's your work again? Because writing, I particularly take my hat off to you. I'm working with Neil Delamere, who you may know. He's a brilliant Irish comedian. And we're working on a project with the QI Elves, which is going to end up being a podcast. But we've been doing Insta Lives. And he's one of the sharpest. I met him doing The Unbelievable Truth with David Mitchell. Okay. And I've worked on panel shows my whole life, and I've never seen anyone better at a panel than him. He's sharp as, you know, as anything you can imagine. And then he is writing. So in lockdown, I don't think he's writing much stand-up. He might be, but he's definitely managing to write. He's written a brilliant sitcom pilot, which I read and thought was fantastic. And you're obviously managing to write scripts. And I think that's so impressive that you guys are managing to produce stuff like that in these circumstances. I just don't get. So how are you doing it?
I work with a script editor. And so I'll have ideas and then I'll start work on them, and then I'll bounce them off him. That really helps, having somebody else there, I think. But I've kind of decided during this period that I want to co-write more. There's pros and cons, obviously, to both sides of it, whether you're writing on your own. But the whole idea is supposed to be fun, isn't it? And it's just so much more fun when you're writing with somebody else. Obviously, you've got to be on the same wavelength, or not necessarily. Sometimes, you know, someone else has got a different style and that complements you. So that's one big thing I've been mulling over. But yeah, to answer your question, what I was doing the first part of lockdown, I'd read this book. Again, you may have heard of him. Have you heard of Robin Sharma?
No, I haven't.
He's like one of these life coaches. I hadn't heard of him before, but someone recommended this book, The 5 AM Club. So I read that while I was on holiday at the beginning of the year. And it's like that whole, you know, positive, you know, optimistic start to the year. It's a new year, new me, blah, blah, blah. And his whole thing was like, get up at 5 AM, you do this morning routine, and then you're at your desk by 8:00. And so I did experiment with that. Anyway, I did that the first part of lockdown, and it does work. It was working for me, like to be at my desk from 8:00. And then what I would do is I would time myself an hour and a half, which you're supposed to do like quality work, like your best creative work, hour and a half, then alarm would go off, 10-minute break, read or meditate, and then an hour, 10-minute break up till 1:00. And then the idea is from like afternoon onwards, admin, replying to emails. So when I did it.
Yeah, you do the hard bit first then. So you do the creative bit first, because everyone does it the other way around, don't they? And then never gets around to the writing because you get stuck in an ad.
But it's still so hard, because the other thing he says is switch your phone off, put it in a bag, do whatever you need to do to just not have that distraction. But I can't, it's like crack. This phone is like crack. And that's my biggest struggle. So, you know, I maybe write for like 20 minutes and then I just quickly check, have a little browsing. I think that's actually been one of the most positive things for me personally during this period, is to be so aware of my habits that are just ingrained in me. And I said this before, but like just realizing how sometimes my phone can just make me so lazy, just my mind just so lazy, just going automatic pilot. And then before you know it, you've just been browsing on your Instagram feed for 20 minutes. Like, what have I been doing? I've done nothing. And there is an argument to be said, oh, actually, you know what? You need that. You need to give your brain a rest sometimes. But do you really? Not that way.
Do you use any of those apps, those measuring, monitoring your phone time apps, like Moments and those ones?
My sister called me today and she told me, I think I've just started perspiring thinking about it. It was last week, I think it was 4.5 hours screen time. But I will say this,
Four and a half hours the whole week?
No, a day.
Oh, I was going to say, I was like, blimey, you should get a medal. Yeah, my aim is 3 hours a day. That's what I aim for. And that sounds like loads. And I do more than that most days. It's pathetic.
But does that, the thing what I don't know is whether they calculate, if you are listening to podcasts, etc., on their audiobooks, whether that's included.
No, I don't think audio are included, but I do always want to be unfair, because if you're on the go, like, so nowadays that we're all grounded, I'm obviously doing emails at my computer. So that isn't going to count on my phone as screen time. In my defense, when I'm in the real world, and I do, you know, I run a business still, I've got a load of stuff, we've all got stuff going on. Hmm. I will be on my phone answering emails and doing genuine things I have to do. So those apps wouldn't know you're out and about for the day and you're spending like half an hour at a time answering emails in a cafe. Mm. So your screen time should go down when you're desk bound, because all your kind of email stuff wouldn't be on your phone anymore. But I think they're a really good idea, but I get so annoyed by being told I'm on it too much. I just mute it all the time. I'm like, oh, shut up. It's lockdown. Don't have a go at me.
Yeah,
so it's not really exactly working.
Yeah, you can let it slide during lockdown, can't you? I guess it's just like you're just more aware of things, really, of like the way that my mind is working.
I did do a, this will make you, if you're crack addicted to your phone, I did a retreat for a week with no phone, no tech, no newspapers, no contact with the outside world in December. So I totally shut off from it, and it only felt weird for probably not even a whole day. Like, there was a first maybe 3 or 4 hours everywhere I went I was like, where's my and then I realized, and I was staying in it was a sort of in a place, you know, obviously of course it was in a place, but we were in a house, it wasn't a cult, but we were all in it was the Hoffman.
They never let you out again, well, for the next few months, but yeah.
That was it. No, it was anyone listening. It was the Hoffman process, which some people might have heard of.
Okay.
And yeah, there were 24 of us on the kind of program. And so you were in the house, you handed in your phone, you didn't need money, you didn't need anything because you weren't there and food was supplied and you weren't allowed to go anywhere. You could go for a walk outside the house, but you weren't meant to like go into town, have a pint. And it was really, interesting because all week I didn't miss my phone for all the stuff that we've just been talking about, the kind of social media. I felt much better not to be on it. But I just missed my phone for what phones used to be for. I just really missed speaking to my kids, my boyfriend, my mates. That's all I missed it for. And when I first when I first got my phone, I didn't touch it for about 5 hours because I was like, I mean, I touched it and put it in my bag, but I was like, I don't really want to re-engage with the world. I'm a bit nervous. And then for about a week, I barely looked at social media. I just used it for communication. So it was really, now I'm just back to where I was. But it just goes to show you can do it.
Yeah, I've experienced the same. Like I try and go on a meditation retreat every year. And I did a 10-day a couple of years ago. And first of all, you just feel like you're just so blissful. And, you know, it's like your mind has been reset, reprogrammed. But it's so interesting how, like, for the week after, you're feeling those benefits, but then suddenly after being back in London, your hectic lifestyle, etc., everything just goes back to normal.
It does, doesn't it? We're really hardwired. I mean, we all know this, but we're so hardwired in what we've been doing for years. It takes such a massive pattern interrupt to sort of change all of that. Have you meditated for many years then?
I have done, yeah. I was fortunate because my mum was a yoga teacher, so I got into it when I was about 18, and then and then I dipped in and out of it for years, and then I started like doing it probably daily about sort of seven, eight years ago, and it has a profound effect on me, definitely from all aspects, really. Like if I don't meditate for a day, I just sort of like get a bit of brain fog. I just feel different. I don't know, maybe I feel a bit ratty. I can definitely notice the difference. Last week I did this home retreat. The London Buddha Centre put on this, usually they'll do these retreats, and that's who I do these retreats with.
Do you go to the North London one? Which one do you go to?
I go to the East London one. My sister goes to the North London one.
I go to the North London
one. Oh, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, I'll tell her to...
Tell her to look out for you. I've met her because I do a lot of the drop-in sessions there. So obviously no one ever knows who anyone is. So I might have seen her 100 times. Yeah.
So they did a home retreat last week. So you're just doing obviously like meditation via Zoom. But even just doing that, I did 2 hours every morning. I just felt, by the end of the week, just felt great.
Did you? Or maybe I'm going to look, I wonder if the North London one are doing it, because I've been doing the Hoffman process of, I only just realized it because I always ignore any emails that come my way because I'm also disorganized with my inbox. But they were sending out loads of, you know, what to do in lockdown. I thought it was just kind of advice, but they've actually got a brilliant program of stuff they're doing. So I've been doing guided meditations with them at 8 o'clock every morning.
Oh, okay,
and
great.
That's on Zoom, and that's felt really good. I'm doing a webinar with them tonight. So yeah, I'm quite enjoying it because I don't know about you, but I do like meditating in the company of others.
Yeah, I think it makes a massive difference. Well, you're just feeding off each other's energy.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it does make us sound like a right pair of kaftan wearing wankers, but there is something about, yeah, I think there is. And also, I love the fact you don't really find out who anyone is. I love it when you drop into a meditation center for, you know, drop in class and no one really cares like who you are, what you do, what age you are. Nothing.
When you went on your retreat, was there moments of silence?
Days of silence.
Yeah, we had that as well. So
how
the
did
first,
you find it?
Well, I just think it's so interesting, like, because, you know, you have like 7 or 8 days silence and you start to paint pictures of like what people are like. And I started like telling myself stories like this person does this, and you build up this whole thing, and then the silence is over and you start speaking to each other and they're completely different to how you'd perceive them to be.
Yeah, so it started. So the ones you've done, you've started in silence and got to know people after the silence.
Well, sometimes they would have the first 24 hours just sort of like speaking, but you know, you don't get to speak to that many people because there's so many people there.
Yeah.
So you might speak to a couple of people. And then I always find it hilarious, like when you have the group lunches or dinners and somebody's like,
yeah.
Sorry, what?
I know. It's funny seeing you do that. For anyone listening, Steve just mouthed, "Pass me the salt." Yeah. And there was because it is an audio medium. But yeah, it's funny. Exactly the same thing. And also, we were sharing rooms. I don't know about you, but so obviously, no one's monitoring whether you're doing it in your room or not. But me and the person I'm sharing a room with, we did do it, but we didn't know each. By the end, we knew each other well enough. We'd have probably found it really hard to keep silent. But I think in the beginning, I was like, "Oh, I better not break the rules," and she might dog me in, you know. So it was really weird sharing a room with someone I'd never met in silence for a couple of nights before I got to know her. But yeah, I found it a real relief, and I'm a right old yakka box, as you can hear, but I found it a real relief not having to talk. I'm sure everyone around me found it a brimming relief. I got home, everyone was like, "Why don't you try it here, Mum? It'd be great."
Yeah, no, I thoroughly recommend it to people to do. And also, I think like from a creative perspective, you need to give like your mind time off.
Yeah, you do.
It's like if you get to a point where you're just trying to force it, I don't think that's great. Although there is, you know, a school of thought to be said, well, you know, you've got to treat it like any job. You've got to show up every day and do the work. But I don't know. I'm still torn about that. You know, like you don't want to wait for inspiration to hit. But at the same time, it needs to be dealt with delicately, creativity. Well,
there's Grania Maguire, who I'm sure you know, recommended. I did Grania's writing course, which anyone listening, I would thoroughly recommend. She's brilliant, and a brilliant comic and a brilliant writer.
Was the writing course specifically comedy focused?
It was comedy focused, and there's definitely, you know, she's great. She's written for lots of kind of panel shows and topical shows. So there was a good chunk on topical kind of joke writing. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely really brilliant way to sort of just learn how to sort of structure your. She's a great, very talented, very clever person. But she gave us lots of kind of assets to watch and read and do stuff with. And she recommended a John Cleese speech. It's quite old. It's a few years old. And it was him doing some kind of corporate for whoever it was. And I think it was about creativity in business was why he'd been booked. But actually what he spoke about was the creative process and about the idea that you put in all those hours and you just, like you said, you turn up, it's your job, you keep turning up. And then even if nothing comes in the hours you turn up, then later that day or the next day, it frees up the capacity for the thing you need to come. So it might never come when you're sitting trying to let it come.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you do that bit, the real creativity doesn't ever come. So it's a bit like Seinfeld said it, I think. He said that after a few years of being a comic, he was thinking, oh, I'm not getting anywhere, you know, no one's noticed me, why am I doing it? And then he was sitting in a cafe wondering whether to give up comedy, and he saw some construction workers outside kind of coming back from their lunch break. You know, they finished their sandwiches and they were going back to the building site. And he looked at them and he just had this revelation that, you know, yeah, they might not want to go back to work right now, but they've had their sandwich and they've got to go back to the site. And why do I think I'm any different? So he was like, my work ethic stunk until then. And he said, and then I realized, yeah, if this is my job, I need to turn up and do my job every day. So from then on in, he had a proper work ethic around writing, and that's when his career started to take off. So, I mean, by those measures, I don't deserve to have a comedy career because I'm completely undisciplined.
I wanted to talk to you about your sort of like time management, because you've got your own company, you're a stand-up comedian, and you're also a mother of two. How the fuck do you do it all?
Well, first of all, it's much easier now because my kid's on stage. I say I'm a single parent of two teenagers because it flows better and there's better material to be done about being a parent of teenagers. But in actual fact, my kids are older than that. So I've got a 20-year-old and a nearly 23-year-old.
Okay.
So I have been a single mum most of their lives. So there have been definitely elements of juggling over the years. And I've been often the sole breadwinner, certainly always the primary breadwinner. So there's definitely been challenges, although no more than loads of people listening will be going through. So I don't need a kind of sainthood for that. But it's got easier now, much easier. You know, I didn't do my first ever gig was when my daughter was 14, my little one was 14. And the reason I could start comedy then was because I didn't need a babysitter anymore. You know, until then I worked full time. How could I possibly work full time, pay a babysitter and go out in the evenings? I'd never have seen my kids. But by the time they were 14 and 17, they couldn't give a shit. They were delighted that I was going out at night. So that definitely had an impact on why I started comedy so late. And in terms of kind of getting stuff done, I do sort of know how to get stuff done. I'm definitely quite hard. I'm a grafter for sure. And I suppose I'm quite organized. And I'm really, as you're probably hearing on this, as much as there's a sort of light, silly side of me on stage and stuff, I can be quite serious about getting stuff done. You know, I'm quite determined. So I suppose, yeah, so, you know, they say, don't they, that, you know, determination is a great, you know, alternative to talent. And I suppose maybe that's what I've got, lots of determination. The one time management tip, if anyone listening doesn't know it, and you know, you probably do know it, but I talked about it on our Insta live show the other night, is the Eisenhower matrix,
which
is it's the urgent important matrix. So you Google it and everyone, so Eisenhower is in President Eisenhower. And the theory was he was quite busy and he had to work out how to manage his time. Shame that our current president doesn't do that. But anyway, and he came up with a sort of quadrant. I'm drawing this out with my hands, which is hugely helpful for a podcast. But it's literally like a quadrant, so like a cross.
Yep.
And there's an axis of urgent, non-urgent, and an axis of important, non-important.
Okay.
And the theory is you should only be working in the urgent side of the quadrant. So why are you doing anything you should only be working in the important side, not the urgent side. So why are you ever doing anything that is not important? And what you realize when you plot what's on your radar is loads of stuff you're doing is urgent but not important. That's where we spend most of our lives. And what are we doing? If it's not important, why does it matter if it's urgent? Why are we doing it? And where you want to be is often in the stuff that is non-urgent but important. So the stuff that you really should be doing and want to be doing. So if you look at your analogy of how you would structure a day, and according to the 5 a.m. Club book, what that book's basically doing is saying, get your important stuff out of the way first. It's not urgent, but it is important. And then do your urgent stuff later. So your urgent stuff might be, you know, you've got to sort out your broadband or your gas bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that book is basically saying, do your important first and then worry about urgent, which is another sort of approach to this same thing. So people Google the Eisenhower matrix. It's a really, really good way of assessing what you should be putting your energy into and what you should, because, you know, I always used to say when I was at Viacom to my kind of staff that, you know, because we were overloaded always with work. And I used to say, you know, you've got to choose which hill to die on. You know, you're not going to do everything. So what are you going to say no to? And how are you going to say no to it? And are you going to give it to someone else, or are you just going to ditch it? Because you'll never get it all done.
Yeah, the idea of saying no is so important. It's something that's taken me a long time to get better at. I feel bad. I feel bad about saying no to things. It's not even just bad, like, you know, the FOMO thing as well. Oh, don't want to miss out on that.
I know. Just say no. I'd be really bad. I'd be the worst person to work for Nike on that ad campaign. Just say no. Just don't do it. But I think it is, just because you can't do everything. And it's a bit like, you know, when you're dating the wrong person, you're never going to meet the right person because you're with the wrong person. So you're putting your kind of dating hours into that person. So you're not opening, you know, you're not opening life up to another person coming along. And it's a bit the same when you're busy doing all the wrong things that aren't really helping you get somewhere. In whatever, when I say get somewhere, I don't mean get somewhere financially. I mean, do what you want to actually do.
Yeah.
Then you're blocking all the time you could be doing something else. So time spent on the wrong things really does take time. So I think I probably have a bit of a sense as to what matters to put my energy into, but I mean, not always. I do work. I'm a bit of a workaholic. That's probably more.
Are you?
So yeah, I do. Anyone who's knows me well would say I'm a bit of a workaholic.
So what do you do to unwind? I know you said you run. You know, what else do you need to sort of get some respite?
I find it really hard to switch off. And I very rarely like watch telly. And I think that's probably because I've worked in telly my entire career. So for me, it's slightly less relaxing. It feels a little bit like that's what I've always done. And I've had to watch a lot of telly over the years for work.
Right.
So I'm kind of associated. Sometimes I'm sitting down with a TV show. It's because I'm meant to be doing something with it.
Yeah.
So a little bit of telly, but not as much as most people probably. So reading. So I find either reading or audio books. Love audio books. Love podcasts. I'm a massive podcast fan. Yeah, running or any kind of exercise. I love getting outside. So anything green, nature, whatever, and it's just being outside really helps me. Mindfulness and meditation really help me. And it is a real constant struggle. You know, I'm a real candidate for burnout because I don't find it easy to stop.
Well, that's why I started this podcast. To be honest, like I wanted to find out how other people are trying to get any kind of degree of balance in their lives. So I can fully relate to that. On the topic of books, are there any specific books that come to mind that have had a major impact on your life over the years?
Yes, the answer to that is definitely yes. But they've mainly not been sort of self-development type books. They've mainly been, I mean, I've read, you know, Stephen Covey and Malcolm Gladwell and all the kind of usual suspects, but they've probably more been, I've listened to things that have kind of changed my life in terms of things I've heard on podcasts and on the radio. So no, it'd be hard to pick a book. There are certainly novels. I mean, I studied English at uni and I've read, you know, I'm a big reader of novels. There have definitely been novels that have sort of, that would stick with me forever and that have kind of broken my heart or changed the way I see the world. But yeah, probably on the self-help side. I mean, people like Brené Brown, you know, the whole concept of vulnerability and her book Daring Greatly is pretty, that's a big old eye opener. You know, but you can obviously get a lot of what she says in the book from her TED Talks and her TV shows. There are concepts like that where I'm like, oh wow, yeah, vulnerability in your life and letting that in and talking about that, well, that's a bit of a head fuck. I never thought about that. So there are definitely things where the scales have fallen from my eyes. What about you? Have there been books? I mean, obviously, you've got your 5 a.m. club.
Yeah,
I've got that. Like, shut up about the 5 a.m. club.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of books that I haven't said before, though that's not very helpful to you. In terms of books that I said before, there's a few that have had impacts on me in specific ways. A book called Finding Ultra, which is by a guy called Rich Roll, who's got a podcast, and it was basically about how he went from being an alcoholic, sort of on the verge of having a heart attack, to becoming a vegan endurance athlete and like one of the top 25 fittest men in the world in his sort of early 40s. That got me into doing triathlons, and it was also partly responsible for me going on a plant-based diet.
Right.
I really like,
you really are annoying me, Halsey, aren't you?
Yeah, but it's more like, but I think it's, I don't know if it's healthy, it's more neurotic healthy.
Yeah, well, I've dated a couple of people who've been into doing I never know whether you call them Iron Men or Iron Mans, but yeah. I've dated a couple of men who were into that, and bloody hell, people are like, oh, they must have been really sexy. I'm like, they were bloody boring. All they did was worry about their, you know, if someone's training for an Iron Man, that's all they're doing. You're at best a small inconvenient detail. So I don't know if, I guess triathlon is a level of obsession below Ironman, but you must still be absolutely relentlessly on it to do that.
Yeah, I'm training every day. I'm not doing triathlon training so much at the moment. I am going for big bike rides, but you are right, it's quite obsessive. I just want to, I don't even know why, I just want to do like one full Ironman and then I'm done.
That's what everyone says, Steve, and then they do their first and then they're like,
I know, it's addictive, isn't it?
It is addictive. It's like, you know, your first marathon, your first anything, you know, you come away from it and you just want to do the next challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, this is true. Other books, there's this amazing one by Yvonne Chouinard, who is the founder of Patagonia, the brand. Yeah. I just love that because it was kind of like part autobiography, but also his like principles as a business leader. But
I've seen him speak somewhere. I was at a thing,
he's amazing.
He was a fellow speaker at something I did. Yeah, it was really, really, he really interesting guy.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. And for me, that was just like, he just lived a life of authenticity, like complete, you know, authenticity. And I really was inspired by that. And then in terms of comedy stuff, I love Steve Martin's.
Me too. That was one of the books I read before I started. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so there are a few. And then fiction-wise, one that has stuck with me as of late is a book called A Little Life. You heard of that?
Write this down as well.
It's really good. It's really good. It's about these... It's about friendship. It's to sum it up, just a book about friendship. Completely original book about friendship. But it's a very, very powerful book and it just stays with you for ages after. Yeah, yeah. It's a tearjerker, though.
I do. I love a tearjerker. I did, funnily enough, and I know now it's a real cliche to say it because the TV show is so massive, but I absolutely love Normal People.
I never read it.
It's so good. And I've actually only just started, even though the series is finished, I've only just started watching it on iPlayer because I love the book so much. I thought, I'm not sure I can bear to watch what they've done with it.
Yeah.
And then I just dipped in and thought, I'll just have a little look. And then I thought, no, I really like what they've done with it. But that was, and if you haven't read it, I think that's a brilliant book. Okay. Yeah, really brilliant.
Okay, I'll give you. I had the same about Harry Potter. I love the books so much. I still haven't watched the films.
This is linked to Harry Potter a bit. Have you read the Philip Pullman books? Have you read Northern Lights and all of those?
No.
Oh well, that if you like Harry Potter, I mean, it isn't the same, but it's that sort of epic adventure, beautiful. Okay. So yeah, and ones that are great for adults and kids. So yeah, the Pullman trilogy, the Northern Lights, Amber Spyglass, and whatever the other one is. And then he's also written two more recent ones that are sort of the prequels. So I'm just on the fifth of those five books at the moment, and they're brilliant. So if you like Harry Potter, then read some Philip Pullman.
Okay, fantastic. I will noted. That is noted. And then I wanted to just ask you one thing. How did you find your Edinburgh experience, having been sort of on the industry side of things? Because I think more than anything, like being in Edinburgh Fringe Festival as a comedian, like you're just like, you're in the thick of it. And it's like, oh shit, this is
it's
quite intense.
Real.
Yeah, it's got intense. When did you do your first Edinburgh? After how long doing stand-up?
Not long. So me and Catherine Bohart did a two-hander called Catcall about a year after we started.
Yeah.
And we were she is very ambitious and very talented, and I'm pretty ambitious. So we were a kind of a good match in that regard, and we were a good match in all regards. And she and we really went at that two-hander like it was. I'm going to show you the poster. Hold on. I know this isn't helpful on a podcast, but I'm going to describe. So you'll see that's the poster.
Great. Love the colours. Yeah. Very striking.
So that looks like a proper kind of Edinburgh poster, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
What we were doing. And we'd done a bit of radio by then. So we had a couple of, like, we could put Radio 4 on and stuff. And we called it Catcall, you know, short for Catherine and Callie.
Great.
And it was feminist. It was looking at women. She was 20-something. I was 40-something. We're both ginger, both women. Both slept with men and women. It was that kind of, so we had a lot in common, but a lot not in common. So the show, so we did a very, very polished, though I say so myself, two-hander, which got Catherine signed by Hannah Chambers, you know, best, mm-hmm. best agent in the business, and got me some decent kind of attention. So that was our first one. So even though it was a two-hander, we probably took it a bit more seriously than some do, for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. And then the next year I did Supercali Fragile Lipstick, which was my first solo show.
I love that title.
Yeah,
the title. I remember seeing that all around Edinburgh. Like, that is banging. That poster is great.
Well, it was the best thing about the show, to be honest with you.
I don't believe it.
Well, it was too early to do a debut. So I did my debut a couple of years after starting, which is very, very early. And it was
Sorry to interrupt you there. I did mine. It was completely out of naivety. I did mine after 3.5 months.
Well, there you go. And how did it go?
First half was terrible. Second half was all right. I had two venues. I couldn't get it because I applied so last minute. I couldn't get one venue for the whole month, so I didn't know what I was doing. But anyway,
it's amazing to have that content. It took me even after 2 years. I mean, that's what I was going to say. It's my hour show after 2 years was everything I'd ever done that was all right, just welded in together because it's all I had. Yeah. So if I really used all my best material and wrote a little bit new, I just about had my hour. So yeah. it was not a bad hour of stand up. I mean, it wasn't terrible. I got 4-star reviews and I did all right with it, and I sold out most nights. So you could say, well, that's amazing, but it wasn't an amazing show. It was fine. And then Invisible last year was sort of much more of a meaningful show for me. That was the year I turned 50, and it was inspired by that French guy. There was a 50-year-old French sort of B-list celebrity called Yann Moix, who made global headlines when he said a woman at 50 is invisible. And I was like, is that right? So then I decided to go big on being visible. So it just worked to my advantage that Brilliant. It was the year I happened to turn that age. So yeah, my Edinburgh experience basically can best be summed up, having been in the industry my whole life, as going from being somebody to being nobody with no transition, because no one cares about a new comedian in Edinburgh, and everyone cares when you work for Comedy Central or ITV. So I used to be the person everyone wanted at every party, and people couldn't be nicer to me. And suddenly everyone's like, Callie, who? So yeah, it was a
bit hard? Was that hard for you to deal with that transition?
It wasn't hard ego-wise, no, because I don't, things like money and status don't really blow my skirt up. So I found it really, really liberating that no one cared. I was like, I love this. No one gives a shit who I am or what I've done or whether I've got kids or what my job's been. Yeah. So that was hugely liberating, but it really did mess with my psyche a bit, not because of status, but it's just incredibly hard going to Edinburgh, and I'm not as resilient as I might seem. You know, I'm a very flawed person emotionally. I really struggle with life, and I struggle with thinking I'm not good enough and thinking I'm always the outsider looking in. And all those kind of insecurities, as you know, really get dialed right up to full volume in Edinburgh. So Edinburgh's properly, I mean, particularly Supercali Fragile Lipstick that year, I properly kind of almost fell apart up there. I did not do well psychologically. I did better last year. I went in more forearmed last year, but I'm not mentally a good candidate for Edinburgh. I suffer from too many demons to cope well in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I think everyone's the same.
Some people complain, but they seem to actually like it.
I think obviously, if you are having like a dream Edinburgh run, and you've got audiences every day, you don't have to worry about any of that side of things, then, and you're all mentally efficient, you know, emotionally efficient, then yeah, the very small minutiae are going to be fine, but. Yeah, it's a challenge. It's tough. It's definitely tough. I haven't done Edinburgh since 2017. I don't have any major intentions to do one anytime soon at the moment. Not at the moment.
But anyway, you can't.
I can't anyway. Yeah, exactly.
So your decision is made. Take it off your list of decisions for the next year or two.
One less thing to worry about. That makes me feel a lot better. Well, look, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and speak with me. We got
Pleasure.
There in the end.
We did. I'm really sorry that it's ironic you said you're really good at time management when I utterly buggered you around for weeks on end. But as you know, I wanted to do it. It just didn't come together.
It happens. You're a busy lady. I was going to ask you about panel shows, but kind of panel shows are panel shows. You've done a few panel shows, haven't you? You've done a fair few.
Yeah, I mean, I did do an episode of QI literally 4 days before lockdown, and it was the last one they recorded with a studio audience, and even then they spread out the studio audience. So we did have an audience. And then the ones they did another couple the night afterwards, where apparently they did them with no audience.
Yeah.
And then they had to stop the recording. So mid-series. So I did hear that that one, I did it with Aisling Bea and Holly Walsh. And I did hear from, a rumour had it from QI Towers that it was going out sooner than later. But anyway, I haven't, I never watched them anyway. I've never watched anything.
Do you enjoy doing them? Do you find them quite?
I love doing them when I get there. I find them really stressful because I suffer from imposter syndrome, you know, as much as the next person. So I'm always like turning up there going, oh, there's been a terrible mistake and it's going to be awful. But I you know, I really loved the last one. Yeah. Every time I do one, I think that every comedian in the business wants to be doing one. So if I'm going to be all, you know, mealy mouthed and go, oh, I hate doing them, everyone will be like, why don't you piss off? Because I'd like to do it. So I think, you know, you've got to, if you're there, you've got to enjoy it and blooming appreciate it. So you're lucky to be there.
For sure. For sure. Okay. I'm going to ask you, final question I ask all the guests on the podcast. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
So balance to me... Well, I suppose I think about it in the terms in which I kind of meditate. This is going to get very, this is getting very on a beach in a kaftan namasteing, so strap in. But it is, so there's a, the concept of the sort of the aspects of yourself. So obviously the, your body and your intellect and your emotion, your emotional self and your spirit. So those four things. When I meditate, I very much look at that sort of quad of four things, and I check in with those. So when I meditate, I always check in with those four aspects. And I think you're doing okay if the needs of all those four things are being met. So if I can have a day where the needs of my body, my intellect, my emotions, and my spirit are being met, not necessarily evenly, but if they're all being attended to in some way, then I suppose at a kind of existential hippie level, for me, that would be balance. And at a more everyday level, I think it is about if you're able to, and it's what you said, you know, writing with somebody, how do you actually start to enjoy life again and enjoy writing again? So if you're getting through your day with doing some things that fulfill you and give you a sense of purpose, but above all, if there's any sense of playfulness and enjoyment, then probably the balance in your life's okay. If you completely lose your sense of playfulness and everything just becomes a trudge, then the balance isn't where it needs to be. So I guess there's an element of playfulness and fun in balance for me as well. So yeah, that's what it means to me.
Great. Love it. Thank you. Where can people find out more about Cali? Where is the best place to go?
So my website, which hasn't been updated for ages, because what am I going to put on it right now in lockdown? but callibeaton.com. So that has all my live dates, as and when I have live dates. I'm also at Callibeaton Comedian on Twitter. Insta, I'm at Callibeaton on Twitter. If anyone's listening and is interested in sort of the broader side of what I do beyond comedy, then the best place to read up about that is on Hannah Layton, my manager's website. So she's got the full kind of what I do on the corporate side, sort of the holistic me, so not just comedy me. So there's various ways to find me, and you can book me for weddings, bar mitzvahs, Zoom conferences, funerals, not funerals, bad joke. But yes, like most comedians, I have capacity right now.
Okay, fantastic. Well, look, again, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. Perfect.
So there we have it. Cali Beaton, hope you enjoyed that conversation. We got there in the end, as Cali had referenced in the conversation. We've been going back and forth. She's a busy lady, and we had to rearrange a few times, but we got there in the air, and it was definitely worth the wait. So as I said, I hope you enjoyed it and you found it inspirational. And as always, please do rate and review the podcast. If you go into the show notes, you'll see there's a review link, so you can literally just click on that and you can review very expediently and effortlessly, and it helps the podcast no end, just getting it up the algorithms and so forth. And once again, thank you for listening, and have a good one.
Balancing Acts is now made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who are a website and community that support independent comedy creators such as myself. I have a Comedy Crowd Short, which is a 2-minute video, one of my characters, on their website. They showcase the best new videos on Comedy Crowd TV, which is comedycrowdtv.com, and across media platforms. So do go and check them out.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.